You are listening to episode 16 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is the GNU World Order, and my name is Klaatu, and this is a show about POSIX, Linux, GNU, BSD sometimes, Illumos sometimes, and every other possible topic that you can think of that has anything to do with computers, technology, and programming. In this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about some news items again, just because, again, that's just kind of something that's been happening, and maybe a little bit about Linux packaging, a cool GNOME-related video made on Blender that you should probably see, a neat little MP3 player for Blender that you might want to check out if you are someone who listens to MP3s in Blender, and some other stuff, too. So let's get started. Under normal circumstances, I would start out with listener feedback. But I don't have listener feedback to start out with today because I'm recording this in advance, so people have not even had time to respond to the previous episode because it hasn't even posted yet. No listener feedback today. I do have a little news story of sorts that I wanted to kind of address just because it's kind of important, and it's about TrueCrypt. I never was really a TrueCrypt user myself. I did play around with it once or twice a long, long time ago. And I did have a slight soft spot for it because it was cross-platform. But I never really got into it that much. And I think part of it was because it felt a little bit unnecessarily GUI to me. It really did seem a little bit, overly GUI. I mean, to encrypt and then, decrypt and mount a volume, to have to go through this other program just never felt really very native on any platform for me. So I just kind of never was compelled to use it myself. No one in real life has ever asked me about encryption that I can recall, outside of the very hardcore geek community. So I never really recommended it to anyone. And all of that just sort of being true, I also never quite felt completely comfortable with TrueCrypt because there was no community around it. Its developer, from what everyone says, is just kind of like this unknown person. Like, no one knows who the developer is. They are apparently someone who developed the thing and threw it online one day, and and there it sat. And for a very long time, I guess no one had ever even bothered looking at the code. And by no one, I mean no community. You know, if you think about a GNU software project, you might think, who's looking at this code? Well, you know that there's like a bunch of people working at GNU. There are people who call themselves GNU hackers. You know, they've got meetings. There is a definable community. If you're asking about a certain distribution, there's a community, there's a core team putting the distribution together, there are support teams around it to support it. There's again a definable community, but around TrueCrypt there was not really ever any kind of sense of community. You never really could tell who was involved with the project because apparently no one was, and people would often cite it as something that you could use, and they might say excitedly that it's a great application, really easy to use, and all this other stuff. But yeah, there was never any. I mean, I guess there's just like no accountability, and I know that's an argument frequently cited about open source software in general. There's no accountability, but yes, there is. I mean, there are developers who kind of identify as the developers of this thing, and TrueCrypt, apparently, there was none of that. And, I mean, that alone isn't that big of a deal. I mean, it's an encryption software, so you kind of do want to think, okay, well, some of us kind of know someone knows this person, right? And apparently no one did, and then after the NSA thing became officially public, I mean, in my mind, it was public for ages, but apparently in everyone else's mind, it's a complete surprise that NSA is actually spying on people. Go go figure. But after that happened, someone started a Kickstarter project that would audit all of the code of TrueCrypt, and they audited it and found that it was pretty good, apparently. And then suddenly, there's this mysterious post. If you haven't been there, you should go. TrueCrypt.sourceforge.net. Very mysterious post about how it is not, it's not secure and you shouldn't use it and it's not being developed anymore. So a very sort of kind of surprising and bizarre course of events. Not really sure what to make of it, other than maybe just a moody developer. Just kind of like, maybe they got hurt by the audit's finding that some of the code was sloppy and maybe not as good as it could be, but not really all that bad. You know, maybe they just decided to call it quits, or maybe they really did just use it on Windows. I mean, maybe that was one man's itch that he was scratching on Windows XP, and then when XP became literally unsupported, the person stepped away from it. I don't know. Maybe it was a Microsoft secret project. I really don't know. No one knows. But it is something that apparently no longer exists. TrueCrypt, right now at least, is dead. Now, whether someone forks that, whether someone has already forked it in the time that, you know, it was announced, in the time I'm actually recording this episode, who can say? Either way, you should use TrueCrypt with a grain of salt if you use it. And as for me, I'm going to just continue to use GNU-PG because it's just kind of what I've been using, really. I mean, GNU-PG is also cross-platform. It's not GUI, but I think there are GUI frontends for it, I think. And it really, it kind of works for me. I mean, I don't know how great its encryption is in terms of standing up to the bad guys and the spies and so on, but it definitely gets the job done. And it works for me for container type files. You know, if I need to tar something up and then GPG it, I can do that. I can open that back up and look at the files and then ditch those files and keep my GPG copy. Whatever. It goes really smoothly for me. I have no issues with GNU-PG. So, you can try GNU-PG out. I've done lots of different tutorials on it, as far as I can recall, so I'm not going to do anything right now. Although, just in case you didn't know, it is really, really easy to GPG something up for yourself. So if you've got, for instance, I know I just said I wasn't going to do a tutorial on it, but this isn't a tutorial, this is just a, oh, by the way. So if you've got, like a tar, or let's say you have a file full of passwords, right, and it's called passwords.txt. And then you decide, well, you really ought to encrypt that thing. So you can do gpg dash dash encrypt, and then passwords.txt. It says that you haven't received any, or you haven't defined any recipients. So you need to enter the ID of the user. You can do that any number of ways, but I usually just put in, like, the name of the person in my keychain who I'm encrypting the file for. So in this case, it's just Klaatu. And then it says, okay, here's the key that I came up with for Klaatu. Is that correct? Yes, it is. And then enter the user ID. So it's assuming at this point that I want to encrypt it for another person, but I don't. So I'm just going to hit return. And now it just exits silently, but if I do an ls on passwords.asterisk, sure enough, there's a passwords.txt, which is the unencrypted version, and then passwords.txt.gpg, which is the encrypted version. Now, to read that, of course, it's just dash dash decrypt. One thing you should know about that, though, is that it's going to, by default, spit the output out to your terminal. So if it's just a passwords.txt file, which, by the way, you shouldn't have and should never do this anyway, but if it's some file that has information in it that you don't want other people to see, maybe that's fine. You know, if you do a gpg space dash dash decrypt passwords dot txt dot gpg, if you do that and it prompts you for your password, which you enter, and then it just spits the contents of that file out into your terminal, and that's it. If it's something else, if it's something that cannot be read in your terminal, like if it's a binary kind of, or you know, XML or something, like a LibreOffice document, you know, that you need to see or open up, then you'd need to direct the output, you know, with the greater than sign to, for instance, passwords.txt, or in this example, I guess it would be more like, you know, passwords.odt or whatever it is. So, or, you know, I mean, yeah, it can be anything. I mean, anything that's like binary or just more than plain text, or if it's plain text that you're going to then want to search through, you would have to redirect that output so that it dumps it into a file instead of to your terminal. But yeah, I mean, it's worked quite well for me ever since I really started using it, which has been quite some time ago now. So, TrueCrypt, yeah, a little bit suspicious at best, and totally dead in the water at worst. So do take care, and of course there's GNU GPG and Lux, LUKS, which I also did an episode on, quite some time ago now, but you can look in the archives and you'll find how to encrypt stuff with Lux, and that's native on Linux as well, so it's quite transparent and quite good, so use it. Next up is a cool little find that I found online, and it's not really something that you necessarily need to look at. I mean, it's kind of old news at this point. I mean, vaguely old. It was released for GNOME 3.12, I think, and it's a cool little video. It's really, really slick, and that's kind of what really attracted me to it. Well, that and the fact that it was made in Blender. So if you go to youtube.com and do a search for introducing GNOME 3.12, you'll probably find it. Otherwise, you can go to this short URL, u2.be/in-nancy77cwrjurlg, and that will take you there. But I will also put the URL in show notes, which will be a lot more useful, I predict. The video is quite nice, like I've said. I mean, and it's nice simply because it's really smooth and attractive animation. It's really well done. It looks absolutely fantastic. And yeah, I mean, the cool thing about it is that it was made in Blender. So that's exciting. And GNOME, of course, itself is exciting. And I've said this before. I mean, I've certainly never said it of GNOME 2 at all. I hate GNOME 2. Always did, secretly. I don't know if I ever actually said that out loud, you know, on previous shows, because I didn't want to seem negative towards GNOME 2. But yeah, I can't stand GNOME 2. But GNOME 3 is really, really nice. It's not for everyone. I will be the first to say that. I mean, honestly, it's not even for me, but it is really nice, and I do have it on my desktop, which is running Fedora right now. So it's something that I do use. I keep checking in with it, you know, every now and again. So it's really, really cool. It's attractive. It's got a lot of things going for it. It's something that you should check out. It has it's come a long way in terms of being kind of a complete package as an OS. And I know it's not really an operating system, and I probably shouldn't really say that it is, because that'll confuse the issue. But if you think of GNOME like a lot of normal users are going to think of it, you know, if you sat them down in front of a computer, I mean, that's their operating system right there. What they're looking at when they've got no other application running, that must be their operating system, right? Well, no, of course it's not. But, I mean, to them it is. And so GNOME as an environment has come a long way, and it's making a lot of progress, I think, in in delivering, you know, kind of like everything that people would want when they turn on a computer. I mean, they've got a little software, a software store of their own now, which is nice. I mean, I don't know the lineage of their little software store thing. I mean, their software package manager, I guess, is what you'd call it. I don't know if it's just package kit skinned or what it is, but it exists. And of course, it's got, you know, things like the obvious, like GIMP and stuff like that. But it's got, you know, what's that photo thing? Showcase or whatever it's called. I don't actually remember what the thing's called right now, but you know, the Shotwell is what it's called. They've got Rhythmbox for music. They've got GIMP, of course. Cheese for webcam stuff. Banshee, I guess, for music as well. I don't really know why they have Banshee and Rhythmbox. Of course, they have Inkscape as an option. I mean, that's not really part of it. SimpleScan, I don't know if that's exactly part of it, but it's pretty integrated and pretty nice. And so on and so on. I mean, they've just got, like their own little web browser, I think, now is back. So, I mean, yeah, they've got a lot of great things. It's all very integrated. It's really nice. It looks attractive. It's something that you should look at if you want to. You know, if I use it too much, I get annoyed with it because it's not, for me, it's not quite as great with multitasking as I would want it to be. But if I'm using it for a very specific task or a specific set of tasks in a specific kind of workflow way, you know, it's kind of cool. Okay, so next up is an MP3 player for Blender. This isn't really something that, again, I don't think that this is necessarily something you need to rush out and go get for yourself right now by any means, but it is kind of neat just to see what you can do with Python and what you can do with Blender. And the only link to this thing I have is a paste bin link. So I don't even remember how I found this. It's just a random little application in Python that will work in Blender. It puts a little in your side panel, at least in 2.7 Blender. It puts a little MP3 player. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's silly, but it's really cool. And looking through the code, it's really interesting to see how it's all done. And that's the advantage of like plug-in architecture, right? I mean, users can come up with all kinds of things useful for them, maybe to no one else in the world, but it's something that they can just come up with because that's all they have to do is import some Blender things into Python and start coding. So, if you need MP3 player in Blender, that's the place to go, and I'll put the link in the show notes. Okay, let's break for some coffee and then come back and talk about Linux packaging. It's a big topic, we should tackle it. Linux packaging is a big topic, as I just said, and it is something that can be a wonderful thing and it can be a painful thing. And I think it's something that I kind of want to talk about because of how often it can be misunderstood. I don't think that anyone would say that the current way of doing Linux packaging is the only way that it can be done, because obviously, it's not the only way. Whether or not it's the best way or not is kind of a weird question, because best for what or best for whom? And that's obviously a really significant question. And there are alternatives. There are very real alternatives to the way that it's done right now. Probably the main one that I'm thinking of anyway is Nix. What is it? Nix. I think it's called Nix Packaging. Or it's called Nix, and then you can actually experience it in its greatness at NixOS, or NixOS, I guess you could say it that way, NixOS.org. It's the entire operating system, but the kernel and the packages and everything is done with this Nix packaging system, which kind of wraps everything up in this, you know, with all of these sort of versions of dependencies that then become kind of independent of one another. And you can roll back changes, of course, because that's what everyone always wants to do, I guess. And it's supposed to be very flexible and very, very cool. And that's great, you know, and that's a valid alternative, and you can look into it and find out more about it at Nixos.org. And I've never used it, but I've heard great things about it, mostly from my friend Gubnu. And I'm sure I just said his name wrong. But yeah, that's the alternative, or an alternative. The other alternative, of course, is just not doing packaging at all, right? You can just compile your source, and you know, every time you update, you have to recompile a bunch of other things. And then, of course, there's the alternative to that, which is what we do these days, which is we package stuff up, we list what versions or what software it is dependent upon. Usually we give some kind of minimum or maximum versioning, so that if someone updates libnet out, or yeah, if they update, let's say, I can't think of something, I don't know, Airpone, or no, what is it, Aircrack, I think, and then that, I think, depended on libnet 1.1.4 for a while, and then Aircrack updated, and libnet didn't, and if you did update libnet, it would break Aircrack, or something like that. I could be a little bit wrong on the order there, but it's got something to do with that, and you get the idea anyway, right? I mean, sometimes a version of some low-lying library will break the application that you as the user actually want to run, or vice versa. Well, the overlying application wouldn't break libnet, but it might, or the library, but it might make it so that your version no longer works with the application. So the point is that there's packaging issues, and any OS that you have has the same problem. It just that, you know, different operating systems deal with the problems different ways, and sometimes they don't. You know, I know a lot of people who get angry with Linux over packaging and the way that things are done there will claim that, you know, this never happens on such and such an operating system. And you know, I mean, either those people are fooling themselves, or they're trying to fool us, or they are, you know, they're not using their computer to its fullest. Because as a former longtime user of a non-free operating system with famously self-contained applications, it would still happen. You know, any application, no matter how much you wrap it up into its own container, I mean, unless you bundle the operating system along with that application with TinyCore Linux, that's actually probably an option we should consider. But anyway, unless you put the whole operating system along with the application, it's not immune to low-lying changes. And if you believe that that's something that happens on other app platforms, then you're not using, you know, then you're not doing what Linux can do. You're using only the updated most recent versions, or you're not updating your OS or whatever. You know, you're not doing the same kind of flexibility that breaking your package into components, into modular pieces, affords you. So that's something to keep in mind. And I think one of the great strengths of Linux is that it keeps its distributable software very, very modular. And that does seem like a drawback when it goes horribly wrong, but it's an amazing strength when you realize that you are able to compile a piece of software with this older library and package them together and distribute them together so that that application uses your version of the library rather than whatever got shipped on the distribution, and it still runs. So keep that in mind, because that's an important concept about Linux packaging. It's frustrating if you don't know how to do any of that, and if no one else is doing that for you. That's frustrating, and it kind of, in a way, in a pragmatic kind of like, have I changed your life while you're sitting at your computer trying to get your work done way, that's basically it nullifies it. No, you've done nothing for me, because the application, no matter how much you tell me it's so much better this way, it's not running for me right now, so it's not any good. So in that sense, yeah, it might be useless to you. But on the theoretical side of things, it's actually really, really a powerful thing. And certainly if it was all open source, then it's even more powerful because you can, I mean, depending on how badly you need this application, you could go to extremes to make sure that this thing still works because all the code is still around. So that's the concept behind a lot of Linux packaging. And there are other pragmatic reasons too, you know. I mean, there's like bandwidth concerns and the fact that the primary delivery mechanism for Linux historically has been online, and that bandwidth has not historically been all that great online. And to this day, it's not that great for everyone in the world. So there are still theoretically concerns for bandwidth, and breaking your application into modular pieces does affect the download size. My favorite example of that I noticed, just because that's one of those applications that I was downloading a lot, was for Linux, GIMP is an 11 megabyte download. For proprietary operating systems, GIMP is more like a 150 megabyte download. So it's a pretty major difference. I mean, that is practically, you might as well just bundle the operating system with the application when you start downloading things that are 150 megabytes on one platform and 11 megabytes on the other. Okay, so it's not really, believe it or not, that's none of that is what I'm actually trying to talk about here. What I'm really trying to talk about is packaging done incorrectly. And this I have seen lately on companies that have been distributing things for Linux. And I get the feeling, and I'm not involved with the companies at all, so I don't really know, but I get the feeling, the sense, that they're distributing it sort of by requirements. You know, someone or something has said, either their distribution channel or their higher-ups who have said, look, we need to start tapping this market, and I'm not naming names, but, you know, there have been companies that I just feel like their heart isn't quite in this Linux release, but they had to do it for one reason or another. And you can look at it, and you can tell right away that whoever did this has used Linux for a total of 5 days. I mean, it works, but it's not sustainable, meaning that once you upgrade your distribution, it's probably not going to work anymore. Or maybe after you upgrade your distribution, you know, 5 or 6 times in the future, it's not going to work. And I mean, I've got applications of this sort that have suffered, you know, just from like 3 or 4 years ago to now, they no longer work unless you symlink some libraries and do a few little tiny hacks here and there, and then they start to work again. And these are such simple fixes that it really is, it's literally just, it's bad packaging. In one specific case that I can remember off the top of my head, an application shipped with a library that it needed to run. They included the library itself with the application that they were shipping, and yet when you started the application, it was, you, if you looked at the output, you could see, and the error that eventually stopped it from working, you could see that it was actually pointing to the library on the system. They literally forgot to point their application at the library that they shipped with their application. So they're just defaulting to your system library, even though they're shipping the required version of that library right there in the download that you get. So there have been instances like that, and that's the point where it's not bad programming, it's not bad system design, it's not anything other than you didn't know how to package this thing for a Linux distribution. Simple as that. And that's negligence, you know? I mean, that's not anything other than you just didn't do your homework, and you did it the really lazy way, and sent it out, and you're selling it now, and that's how it's getting to your customers. And this is why big companies have stated in the past, well, we can't, you know, distribute our application for Linux because it's too hard to maintain. And you know, like, everyone who ever heard that story kind of thought, well, how strange is that? Because we've got programmers for all kinds of applications, and they seem to maintain their application just fine for Linux. So why can't this big company maintain the software for Linux? Like, how do you figure that a programmer who's doing this independently can support Linux just fine, and a multi-million dollar corporation with big corporate contracts and market saturation can't seem to squeak by and support Linux? I mean, that doesn't add up right there. But then when you see things like this, it's kind of, oh, well, that's why. Because they're doing it wrong. They're doing it completely wrong. They're doing it so embarrassingly wrong that someone like me, Klaatu, who, I mean, I package, what, like 12 Slack builds, 12 Slacks packages, and like maybe 2 Fedora packages and some Ubuntu packages for some friends. You know, I mean, that's it. That's how great at packaging I am, right? I mean, I'm pretty low in the totem pole. I'm not an approved like Fedora packager. I'm not even an approved RPM Fusion packager. I tried once. I did try to get into RPM Fusion, but the process was just very confusing and not very. Then I moved to New Zealand and everything sort of fell apart. So yeah, I mean, it's not like I'm not the most intelligent, like the most advanced packager, and yet I can see how badly they are implementing this concept of let's get some software to some people. So, I mean, we can complain about this all we want, but that doesn't really do a whole lot. And the reality is that there is a solution. I mean, there's a solution in sight. There's a solution that can be implemented. And the solution is the same as the solution that we offered driver, you know, the hardware manufacturers who needed drivers for Linux and couldn't seem to afford to get someone to write a driver for Linux. And that is that there's this whole community of people who have proven themselves, both within your own market structure and without. You know, there are people who program on Linux for money within, like, a very structured kind of, like, okay, we're going to sell this product now, that kind of thing. And there are people who do it in their spare time. And either way, they've proven themselves as capable. And there's a standing offer from every major distribution that, you know, you give us what we need to package up your application, and we will manage that for you. And yet, companies continually don't take anyone up on that offer, and I just don't understand it. I really don't. I do not understand the resistance of, like, these big software companies to put a little bit of trust into the community that is continually offering to assist them in getting their product out, essentially, to market. You know, I mean, they're saying, we will package this up for you. You can. We'll sign NDAs, you can charge for it, whatever, we can manage it for you. And they just don't. They do not accept that help. And that, to me, is very bizarre. And it's really interesting that companies can, like, there is that big of a communication gap between the way that these two communities work. You know, companies are driven, obviously, exclusively by money. And the community rarely is driven exclusively by money. I don't know if they're ever exclusively by money. At least not the community that I'm talking about. I mean, some people need money to, you know, buy food and stuff. But it's usually because they love doing it first and foremost. And you'd think that those two wouldn't be mutually exclusive of one another. And in reality, they're not, of course, because, again, the Linux community does what they do, but they also have jobs or they also take donations. You know, I mean, there is money as a consideration just because, yeah, that's how things are right now. But it's interesting that the corporations can't even bridge that gap enough to be able to understand why someone would offer to help maintain something essentially for free. I mean, it's like they need the money to be a part of the conversation, or the conversation ends. And that's really, really strange. And it's, you can see it falling apart. Like, every time, like in last week's show when I mentioned Unreal, the Unreal game engine coming to Linux, the Linux community beat the company to getting a Unreal client, or whatever you call it, IDE, whatever, out to Linux. Like, the community did that first. They had that out before the company could get around to it. I mean, that's that. If what more proof do you need that this community is serious in what they're saying? They're telling the companies that they don't need everything to be done for them. We can do some of this ourselves, and we are right now apparently pretty happy to do that. But it just doesn't seem to translate. And why is that? Why is there that? I mean, it's the same language that we're all speaking, and yet there's like this huge gap in being able to actually understand one another, and that's very, very strange to me. But getting back to the topic at hand, and that is, of course, packaging. I mean, we can talk about how bad it is in some cases, but that doesn't really get us anywhere. So how to fix the problem, I guess. And I mean, obviously, in some cases, you can't fix it because it's not you doing the packaging. I mean, that's not always the case. I mean, sometimes it's just, you know, it's done incorrectly and you're kind of stuck with it. But in terms of, like, correctly packaging, there are a couple of different ways to, I mean, I'm not going to go through how to make packages because I did that on Hacker Public Radio. So if you go back onto hackerpublicradio.org and search for RPM and I think BSD ports and I think, well, I know, Slackware. I wanted to say deb for a minute, but I don't think I did a deb. But yeah, in fact, I know I didn't. So, because I don't know how to do debs, I know how to do, like, check install, which makes a deb for you, but it's not really a deb. I mean, it is, but it's not like you're doing it consciously. So anyway, you can learn how to do, like, basic packaging from Hacker Public Radio on my miniseries, but just in terms of talking about how packaging on Linux, like how distributing applications on Linux can work, there are obviously lots of different ways to do it, but I mean, and we've probably seen them all. But one of the most important things to understand is that Linux, the way that it works right now, most Linux applications, they come modularly because Linux itself and most, I would say most Linux-centric applications, they're works of art that are never going to be complete. They're not going to stop development, you know, at least not, you know, if they're at that stage in their life. They're ongoing. And so it makes no sense, really, for them to just release, like, these sort of self-contained binary-type packages like you see on some other operating systems, although not all the time, and not completely. But, you know, they can afford to be very, very modular because they know that the entire environment is a developing thing. Like, it keeps changing and updating, and so they can kind of ride along with that. And that's fine, and usually it's a very safe assumption because, again, there are these distributions, and there's, like, this infrastructure of, okay, well, we're shipping with this version of this library now, and so, you know, everyone kind of knows where everyone else is. And it's pretty safe to do that. And if there's something that's, like so completely different or that breaks something, the distribution, you know, the packaging maintainer can take it upon themselves to develop a package for an older library that will then maintain compatibility with the newer application or whatever the breakage is. So in order to even understand that, I think, there's kind of, like, this is super basic compiler 101. I mean, like, really basic. And that's all I am. I'm not super advanced here. I don't know what compilers do exactly. I mean, I know, but I don't, you know, understand. But one thing I do kind of understand lately is the concept of linking. And linking, you know, when you're compiling software, it goes from obviously the source code to some kind of executable code. And that's usually, what is it, usually machine code, I think, or machine language, I think they call it, I don't know. But it's something that the computer can understand. and process very quickly rather than parsing text and turning that into machine code. It's something that the computer can, you know, that it's instructing the CPU on what to do. So that's what compiling does. But there's this process in the compiling there's this point in the compiling process called linking, which is where they combine, you know, you combine different parts of code together in order to make something, you know, actually an executable binary. And you can kind of think of this, or at least I do, as like an XREF in DocBook, which, you know, if you've not written DocBook, you have no idea what I'm talking about, but I can describe it for you. So let's say I wrote this great paragraph on how to install or how to change a wallpaper in GNOME. And now let's do it in KDE. So I wrote this great paragraph on how to change a wallpaper in KDE. And then I'm writing this article or a book or something on different distributions. And so I might be talking about Slackware, and that's primarily, I would say, a KDE distribution. You know, that's the default desktop. So you might, when you're in Slackware, you're thinking, okay, or you're typing about Slackware, and you're like, oh, I should probably change, or I should tell the user how to change their wallpaper, because that's really important, I guess. And so instead of retyping that whole paragraph, what you could do is take this paragraph and put it into a self-contained file, and then you can, in the Slackware chapter, you can do this XREF link of that one file. And so instead of you typing out the paragraph, it'll just, you know, DocBook itself will go out while it's building your book. It sees the X link, or XREF, whatever it's called. Actually, I think it's Xinclude is actually what it's called. But anyway, a Xinclude, it sees that, and it grabs the file, and it pops it right into where you said Xinclude, the wallpaper paragraph, or chapter, or whatever, however much you want to include. And then when I'm writing the Magia chapter, which really should be a KDE-centric distribution, they have a GNOME version, but I don't really much care for their GNOME version, because a lot of their control panels render strangely. But I'm writing a chapter on Magia, and I'm like, oh, I should probably tell them how to change the wallpaper in KDE. So again, Xinclude, wallpaper.xml, I go out, or DocBook goes out and grabs it and pops it in there, okay? So that's essentially linking, both in DocBook and in actually compilers. So there's two kinds of linking, and you probably have heard of these phrases, but you may not know what they mean. But one is called a static link, and one is called a dynamic link. Now, a static link does more or less what DocBook does. It sees the link, you know, the flag to refer to this library, you know, this module that we're using, and it needs to have that code in the application in order to, you know, it can't just look at the library, right? So it needs the development headers and all that other stuff of the library. So what it does in a static link is it goes out to where the library is, it grabs the code, you know, copies the code, and then it pastes it right into what it's compiling. Like it pastes it right in. So it's like a Xinclude in DocBook. It just copies and pastes. So that text is right there. Now there's the other thing called the dynamic linking, where all it does is it points out to the library, so that when you're running the executable binary, it hits this point while it's running that you want to use something that's contained in, you know, libnet or libusb or lib this or lib that, and so it darts out and looks at the library. Now, if that library is missing, that becomes a problem if it's dynamically linked, or if that library has changed a significant amount since the time someone wrote the application and, like, contained, you know, they counted on the library being one way, and now, you know, many, many years later, you're running the application and the library is some other way, that could become a problem. That could cause a problem. But as you can see, there is a way around that, and it's called static linking. And if you statically link libraries to an application, then it becomes a lot less dependent on any external like library, because now that the code for that library is a part of its executable code. It doesn't need to look at your system really for anything. It's got all of it built in. Now, obviously that, you know, when you're just bringing in libraries and pasting them into your own application, you're making the final binary file is going to be a lot bigger in file size. I mean, that's kind of obvious. Yes, I mean, you're adding lines of code to this thing, so when you do an ls-l on it, it's going to have more bytes in it. Simple. But if your development model isn't the same as Linux and Linux-centric applications, where there's an application or there's a developer, you know, fixing bugs every other week, or you know, releasing a new version every other month, then maybe it would be smarter to do that, to statically link and not dynamically link. Or if you must, you could dynamically link, but point the dynamic linkage to some other location other than just any random user's lib directory, and instead use your own private lib directory. You know, there are different ways to do this. There are better ways to do it. You have to look at what's available to you, because Linux is very, very flexible, actually. You don't need to do everything the way that everyone else does it. It's Linux. You can hack around everything you want to. That's the advantage of it. So don't restrict yourself by just assuming, oh, we have to do it this way, because of the three examples we bothered looking at when we were doing the research for like the 2 hours that we bothered researching the problem, that's how they did it. You know, get someone who knows the system. Get someone to design a sensible packaging format that works for your application and future-proofs it as far into the future as you need it to be future-proofed, you know, especially if your development cycle doesn't match up with everything else, where you're updating every 2 months or 3 months. If you're more of a, like, we'll get an update out to you in, you know, 3 years, then maybe a little bit more static linking there would help your application have a longer life on the Linux platform. Just something to think about. Now, I realize that I don't think that a whole lot of companies that are, releasing these applications in really, really badly packaged formats are listening to this show, so I'm kind of just talking here, but it is something to consider and to be aware of, that Linux packaging, you know, in spite of what new Linux users think, and I think a lot of new Linux users do think that Linux packaging is a problem, and a lot of people have said that it's a problem. You know, like Linux users have said, "Oh, we have terrible packaging; it's a real problem." It's kind of a bunch of people saying, you know, talking about stuff that they don't necessarily know a whole lot about. It's just they're complaining about the end result. They're saying, "Well, one time I had this problem." Ergo, all of Linux packaging needs to be fixed. Now, it's not broken, it's just flexible, and people who don't know how to use it correctly are releasing stuff into that pool, and it, you know, it's not working correctly, because, yeah, they did it wrong. And I mean, I guarantee you there are people out there, and I think I've mentioned him in a previous episode, but I'm going to mention him again, because, I mean, everyone knows he's brilliant. Iculus. Iculus knows how to take stuff and package it properly. I've never had a game ported by Iculus fail, you know, ever. I mean, it's just really old stuff sometimes, and it's still working. I mean, he knows how to do this. He's doing it right. Other companies who don't hire Iculus, or people like him who know how to package stuff up for Linux, they don't have the same amount of success in terms of results, and that's the reason. So, yeah, spread the word. Flexibility and modularity is not a weakness. It's an advantage. You just need to know someone who knows how to take advantage of that. Here we go. Last but not least, I would like to mention a few little icon themes that I've found recently. There are lots of icon themes, it seems, for GNOME. That seems to be kind of a very GNOMic kind of thing. And by icon themes, I don't mean, like, you know, 16 icons or 100. I mean, like, you know, 30,000 icons available right now, and you can install them, and suddenly your desktop and, you know, your file manager and everything will look completely different. So very complete icons or icon themes. And that's, I think, I mean, on any operating system, that's a really tall order, and a lot of times people, you know, people release icon themes, and it hits most of the marks, but not all of them, and a lot of times you have to go through and kind of fix the ones that they missed. So these are very complete icon themes, and they're really, really nice, and I'm just going to kind of mention them just by way of showing support for the icon makers, because largely, I mean, it's a big task, it's an artistic task, it's very cool, and it's something that I used to really be into on the operating system that I used in the past, before Linux. And it was kind of something that I fell out of caring about after I got away from that operating system, because I had, you know, bigger things to change than just the icons. But lately I've been playing around with it just for fun. So one, for GNOME, certainly, I guess the sort of a very popular one right now, or prolific one, I should say. I don't know if they're popular or not, but prolific, is Numix, N-U-M-I-X. And you can go to numixproject.org and find all of their different icons. They've got like square themes and circle themes, and they're really attractive. They're really well done. They host their things on GitHub, and I've not exactly been able to find the source, unless they're doing all of their application or their icons rather in bitmap format, which I guess that's possible, but I wouldn't have thought so. So I'm not really sure exactly where all the source is. I'm pretty sure it's open source. I just wouldn't know where to find the source files. And I'm only saying that because there is that, you know, that one or two things, you know, that one or two application icons that they'll miss, you know, and so you'll think, oh, I should just go in and start with a simple icon, and I'll make my own, or at least that's how I think about it when I notice something not fitting into the theme, and I couldn't find where to do that on those, but I didn't look very hard either, to be fair, because a lot of the icons just didn't quite fit in with the KDE desktop that I was using, or that I use on a regular basis. So the KDE icons then. The two that I've found that seem to be quite complete are Evolvere, which is, if you go to kde-look.org, you should be able to find it. It's E-V-O-L-V-E-R-E, Evolvere. And they've got, like, different, they've got lots of different themes. They've got window decoration theme, they've got the plasma theme, icon theme. You know, you can just have a completely Evolvere desktop. But the icon one is really what I cared about, I guess. So if you want to take a look at that, you certainly can. They're squarish, they're nice, they're really attractive, I think. They're kind of flat, you know, so they kind of look like that new kind of, I don't know, high contrast, kind of like, not line art, flat, I guess, style that I guess HTML5 and CSS kind of have that look now, because a lot of people are doing so much with CSS, pure CSS, and they're drawing pixels, you know, on the screen, so it's pretty flat. It looks nice. And then there's I don't know how to say this one, Faenza, F-A-E-N-Z-A. And he's got a couple of different icon themes. Again, kde-look.org will get you to where he puts his stuff. And, again, it's kind of that flat look. This one's even flatter than the other one. And actually, the theme itself, I've just noticed, it's actually called Faenza Flatter, F-L-A-T-T-R. It is a very flat look, but it's quite nice. It looks really, really good. And you can just download the icons and untar them to your user share icons directory and go to your system settings and, you know, choose that as your icon theme, and it'll change most of the themes. My dolphin instance seemed to have some really, like, ancient stuff that I'd done to it, like, a long time ago. And nothing I did could shake it out of the configuration file. So eventually I just moved my Dolphin configs into an archive folder, and it generated itself as a new, fresh, default Dolphin config, and then it took to all the different theming choices that I was making. But that was a slight oddity. But other than that, it's been pretty smooth. And I just got bored the other day and was changing around the theme, because I've had the same KDE theme for ages, and I just thought, maybe it'd be nice to have a different look. And I haven't done that in a while, so I did that, and it's nice, it's cool. So that's Numix, Fenza, and Evolvere, and those are all three of them very, very complete. And one of the things I liked about, I think it's Fenza, especially, at least, that's the one I've been messing around with the most. They're all scalable, so they're all just SVGs. There's no PNGs. He doesn't mess around with that. It's all scalable vector graphics. That means that, for instance, QTractor did not have an icon, so I was able to make myself a QTractor icon just by copying one of their icons and kind of building off of it and making that my QTractor icon. A couple of others, I didn't feel like they were quite, I guess, what I wanted, so I opened them up in Inkscape and changed them and saved them, and then suddenly my icons were different. So it's really, really cool, and I have to say, it's just so much easier than it was on my old operating systems to change icons. I mean, it's remarkably, remarkably simpler, especially when you're using something that just gives you the SVG files. It's just really, really nice. So check out some of these icon themes if you want. They're nice, or you might hate them. I don't really know. It's a personal preference. But in terms of complete icon sets with lots and lots of icons to cover, everything. I mean, every application, every button, every control panel, just everything. This is definitely one to look at. So enjoy those. This has been the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online via either email, which would be klaatu@member.fsf.org, or on the internet, on the web, rather, via HTTP, GNUWorldOrder.info, StraightEdgeLinux.com, SlackerMedia.info, lots of ways to get to me. So I'm also on Linux Questions sometimes as not Klaatu. And that's how you can find me online. Thank you for listening to the show, and I will talk to you next time.
Bonan matenon, mi estas Petro. Bonan matenon, bonan matenon, bonan matenon, bonan matenon. Bonan tagon, bonan tagon, bonan tagon, bonan tagon, bonan tagon. Bonan vesperon, bonan vesperon, bonan vesperon, bonan nocton,
bonan nocton,
bonan
nocton.